طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's continuing occupation and colonization of their homeland. This program features the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the mainstream media. And that is why it is so important that it is broadcast each week on This Week in Palestine. This is John Roberts. This has been another bruising week for Palestinians and all of us who support them in their struggle to end the colonization and occupation of their homeland. The assault on Gaza is brutal, but the response of our government, the mainstream media, and our universities is equally disappointing and, in fact, totally outrageous. But as our institutions fail us, common folks have gone into the streets in huge numbers to send a message that Israel's genocidal attack on sieged civilians in Gaza must stop. But the killing goes on as the slogan, "Israel has a right to defend itself," becomes the excuse for the slaughter. Do you hear a word about the international right of Palestine to resist an occupation and colonization of their homeland? Of course not. So a context for the resistance is ignored. Harvard's new president, Dr. Claudia Gay, under enormous pressure from big donors, issued a letter to address the crisis. A Palestinian faculty member, Salma Abu Ayesh, responded to President Gay's letter to the Harvard community. I am now going to read Salma's brilliant response. Dear President Gay, first of all, congratulations on being the first black person and second woman to lead this complex community at Harvard. I had tears in my eyes when we celebrated you as a black woman leading this institution, and my smile was ear to ear watching you happily jump into your seat on Inauguration Day. I don't envy you your first public challenge, and you have my deepest sympathy, as I can imagine the pressures you are under being exposed to. I read the Boston Globe article highlighting these fiduciary pressures. As Harvard feels the heat from donors, how much influence should they have on campus? I am a Palestinian Arab, secular, but of Muslim upbringing, and I am hurt and baffled by the letter you sent to our Harvard community on November 9th, with 20 mentions of anti-Semitism and only one of Islamophobia. Nothing about anti-Palestinian and anti-Arab sentiments and attitudes that plague our country, of which our campus is just a microcosm. Being a community of intelligent people does not preclude racism and prejudice, as you know. It seems to me that this ratio of 20 to 1 is roughly how our Arab-Palestinian humanity is being measured recently. And since 100 years ago, when Winston Churchill referred to Palestinians as the dog in the manger. Sadly, your letter is consistent with the general attitudes of our media, government, and it seems university boards as well. This disregard is how we are dehumanized and what allows my people to be slaughtered for over 75 years. This disregard is what allows Israel to kill our people and innocent civilians in Gaza and in the West Bank, as I write this with immunity. This disregard is what allows our government to ignore its responsibility towards its own marginalized people and instead to continue with its imperialistic goals that support a racist apartheid state. This disregard is what allows anti-colonialism and anti-occupation to be conflated with anti-Semitism. I honestly expect more from someone who comes from the revolutionary liberatory traditions of Toussaint's Haiti, and that you proudly mention in your inauguration speech. I need not remind you, a professor of African American studies in government, that this disregard is how people of your background are silenced. The term, "From the river to the sea, Palestine will be free," means liberation of all of historic Palestine from racism, apartheid, and inequality. It is an aspiration for a land with equal rights for everyone, including Jewish citizens. You can call it Israel or whatever you want, but it will be free. Maybe what you should be asking for instead is for Israel to define its borders, adhere to a constitution, neither of which it does, and to end the occupation, its continued colonization of Palestine, and its 65 racist laws that discriminate against its non-Jewish citizens. If two international organizations, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and two Israeli human rights organizations, Yesh Din and B'Tselem, declare Israel an apartheid state, wouldn't you want to liberate it from that as well? In a just world, you'll be chanting along with us. I will not ask you to solve the Palestine question. We will. With the help of our black indigenous, the wretched of the earth, and others who see us, but where is the sense of justice, equality, and inclusion when it comes to my people on your campus? An ad hoc group of concerned students and faculty have already documented over 40 incidents of harassment, doxing, and other forms of violence against Arab Palestinians and Muslim students and their supporters. Please tell me that you are planning a similar advisory board, an effort to look into what our community is experiencing. Respectfully, Salma Abu Ayash. That was a letter written by Salma Abu Ayash, a Harvard faculty member, responding to a letter to the Harvard community from its president, Claudia Gay, concerning responses to the Israel-Hamas war, providing much-needed context that is missing in the Harvard dialogue. Providing more of the much-needed context is this interview with Craig Mochaber, a career diplomat with the United Nations, who recently resigned his position to protest the failure of the United Nations to address the core issues at the heart of the Israel-Hamas war. In our feature presentation today is a report by Al Jazeera that includes an interview with Craig Mochaber, focusing on his critical resignation from the United Nations. Here is the Al Jazeera report.
1945, in a world scarred by war, came a global appeal for peace.
To find a way to end war.
In response, the United Nations was formed. Its mission was clear: to prevent the horrors of another global conflict. But despite the UN's endeavors, its history has been marked by a succession of wars and violence.
The continuance of the Cold War is making the United Nations system more and more unworkable, and thus is undermining its usability.
From Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq, to Rwanda and Darfur, from the Balkans to Yemen, from Syria to Ukraine, and of course, the longest running of them all, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. In the aftermath of the Holocaust, hundreds of thousands of Jewish survivors sought asylum in historical Palestine, a land sacred to Muslims, Christians, and Jews alike.
The General Assembly of the United Nations has made its decision on Palestine.
In 1947, the UN proposed dividing Palestine, a plan rejected by the Palestinians, who were in the majority. And the State of Israel was formed the following year, leading to the displacement of hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. Over the years, Israelis have expanded their settlements, occupying land beyond the UN demarcated partition.
Shame on you for killing thousands of Palestinians.
Despite countless initiatives, the decades-long quest for peace has been interrupted by outbreaks of violence. The Palestinian leadership remains divided. Fatah in the occupied West Bank recognizes Israel, while Hamas in Gaza does not. The UN's presence has been constant, its calls for peace a refrain echoing over the years.
All this must stop. Stop fighting. Start talking. No solutions can come through violence.
We issue statements. We express concern. We voice solidarity, but life hasn't changed.
The fighting must stop immediately.
The protection of civilians must be paramount. The situation in the Middle East is growing more dire by the hour.
October the 7th was a watershed moment. Hamas's surprise dawn offensive outmaneuvered Israeli security. More than 1,000 Israelis were killed, triggering an unprecedented escalation. In response, Israel declared war on the armed group, and in doing so has reshaped Gaza's landscape with unparalleled destruction and the killing of over 10,000 civilians. In the midst of the war, a crisis unfolded within the UN. So divided were members that it took 3 weeks for the organization to pass a resolution on the war. In protest against the UN's failure to condemn what he termed the wholesale slaughter of the Palestinian people by the Israeli army, senior human rights official Craig Mochaber stepped down. His public resignation letter noted that, once again, we are seeing a genocide unfolding before our eyes, and the organization we serve appears powerless to stop it. With Israel's war on Gaza intensifying, Craig Mochaber, the former New York director of the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, talks to Al Jazeera. Craig Mochaber, the former director of the New York Office of the United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights. Thank you for talking to Al Jazeera.
My pleasure.
You have resigned in protest from your job, and you wrote a 4-page letter outlining why you did that, and I want to get to that in a second. But in your words, why did you step down?
Well, I actually began to communicate my concerns about the UN's reaction to gross violations of human rights in Palestine back in March. This was after some of the atrocities that were happening on the West Bank at that time, including the pogroms that happened in Hawara. And what I thought was a trepidatious response by UN officials at that time to the situation. and a kind of effort to silence UN officials who were speaking out, including those in the Human Rights Office. And so I communicated to the High Commissioner my discontent with those issues and indicated at that time that I intended to leave the organization in a few months. Of course, the situation got much worse over that time, in particular in Gaza. And that's why I felt compelled then to write that letter to the High Commissioner, laying out what I thought was a real disconnect between our normative obligations in the UN and the political approach to Palestine and Israel that had become dominant in the political side of the UN. It is a critique of the UN response. It is not a critique of the entire UN, because many of our colleagues doing humanitarian work and human rights monitoring and our UNRWA colleagues, dozens of whom have lost their lives in the last couple of weeks, are doing absolutely heroic work. But in the political corridors of the organization, the ball was being dropped, I thought, in a very fundamental way. And so I sat down and wrote the letter to express that officially to the High Commissioner.
We're going to get to some of those points, but just to be clear, some at the UN are suggesting that this is just a normal retirement, if you will, and not a resignation. Can you clear that up? Did you resign or did you retire?
I resigned earlier than I had intended. I was asked to stay on. There was certainly no pressure from the United Nations. I had a couple of more years to go. But I was particularly frustrated in the inability myself to communicate publicly on these issues. And I thought that I could probably be more influential outside the organization at this point than inside the organization. I'm old enough to retire, but I'm leaving a little bit early.
You could have just handed over your UN badge, walked out quietly, but you chose to write this letter. Why?
Well, for me, it's very personal. I mean, I came to the United Nations for the first time in the 1980s because I was convinced of the strong normative role that the organization was playing at that time, including in situations where powerful member states didn't want the organization to take a strong position in opposing apartheid in South Africa, in those days as well, atrocities in Palestine, death squads in Central America. And I felt that somehow that it slipped. You know, this year is the 75th anniversary of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's the cornerstone of this entire human rights movement. But what people don't often realize is that same year, 1948, that the Universal Declaration was adopted, was also the year of the Nakba in Palestine and the creation of apartheid in South Africa. The UN held a very principled, norm-based, law-based line on apartheid in South Africa until it fell. That is not the approach that the UN has taken in Palestine, particularly since Oslo. There has been a kind of about-face that has moved away from a normative, law-based approach into one that defers to political expediency and powerful political forces that I think is in large measure responsible for the continued deterioration of the situation in Palestine. And so I thought I needed to put on the record how far we were slipping from this normative obligation of the organization, what I thought the impacts of that were and what I think should happen next.
You were fed up.
I was fed up.
Let's get to a little bit of this letter. This letter that you wrote is scathing. Can't think of another word for it. There's a lot to take out of this, but one part is that you say what Israel is doing, not only in Gaza, but also in the West Bank and in occupied East Jerusalem is, and I quote, a textbook case of genocide. Your words.
Yeah. Well, you know, genocide is one of those terms that is very much politically abused. It's claimed in cases where it does not apply. It's denied in cases where it doesn't. You know, after having been a human rights lawyer for 32 years, I'm well aware of the abuse of the term. But we determine genocide based upon a legal instrument, which is the UN Convention on Genocide, that sets out a definition with the elements of genocide, each of which is evident in the current case. Usually the most difficult part of proving genocide is intent, because there has to be an intention to destroy in whole or in part a particular group. In this case, the intent by Israeli leaders has been so explicitly stated and publicly stated by the prime minister, by the president, by senior cabinet ministers, by military leaders, that is an easy case to make. It's on the public record. And then beyond that, you look at the specific acts that are required for genocide. And you see several of those have already been made evident. One of them is creating conditions that prevent, you know, people from living dignified lives and that lead to the destruction of the group. Well, it's not hard to prove that in Gaza, where since really 2015, people have been living effectively in a prison where there is an intentional denial of the necessities of life. You add to that, you know, the massive bombardments and the killings of so many thousands of civilians, thousands of them children. And it seems to me you have a prima facie case for genocide. Now, in the end, this is a determination to be made in a court of law. But it's important that we start using the language that the law sets out. Just as, you know, in recent terms, every major international human rights organization, Israeli human rights organizations, Palestinian human rights organizations, United Nations human rights mechanisms, independent mechanisms, have found that the situation in Israel and Palestine amounts to the crime of apartheid. The UN needs to get used to addressing these particular violations, just as we have in other situations.
When we ask the Secretary General in his office about genocide, he won't use that term. He says, and previous Secretary Generals have said, that that is for courts to decide. Do you think that the Secretary General should start using the term genocide when it comes to what we're seeing happening in Gaza?
Well, I understand the position of the Secretary General and some of my own colleagues in the UN. When they speak publicly, they're speaking on behalf of an institution. And in doing so, there are very complex processes that need to be gone through before one can make those sorts of pronouncements. And in the end, any crime is to be determined by a court of law. But if we can allege that we see war crimes, crimes against humanity, as we have often done, there's no reason to exclude, where we see very strong evidence, the possibility of genocide being committed. And I think you're going to be hearing that term more and more in connection with what we're witnessing in Gaza. But institutions, of course, have to go through the necessary steps before they can make that pronouncement. I, as of today, am an independent citizen, not carrying the institution on my shoulders. And I feel quite confident as a human rights lawyer in saying that what I see unfolding in Gaza and beyond is genocide.
Israel has admitted to bombing a refugee camp in Gaza not once, not twice, maybe even more times. They've bombed UN facilities, schools, hospitals, and forced the displacement of civilians. Presumably, these are violations of international law. Am I right or am I wrong?
They are violations of existing international law. They are gross violations of human rights, and they are grave breaches of international humanitarian law of the Geneva Conventions. And this applies very much to Israel. It applies as well to states that are supporting Israel in this campaign. You know, everyone who is a high contracting party to the Geneva Conventions is responsible not only for respecting the rules in the Geneva Conventions, but for ensuring respect vis-a-vis other states over whom they have influence. In this case, it's very clear that countries like the United States, the UK, and others have a great deal of influence over what Israel is doing. Not only have we not seen those countries exercising their influence to ensure respect for the Geneva Conventions, but we've seen them, in fact, arming Israel, providing economic support to Israel for these campaigns, providing diplomatic cover, including in the Security Council, for example, vetoing a humanitarian ceasefire. And all of this is in breach of their obligations as well under international humanitarian law.
How is Israel able to get away with it then?
Well, this is one of the great frustrations of people working in the field of human rights. The enforcement power of the international human rights and humanitarian law regime is weak. It's stronger now than it was when I started in this business, because we do have the International Criminal Court, international tribunals from time to time, experiments in third-party universal jurisdiction in these cases. There are a whole series of commissions of inquiry and independent investigative mechanisms that are documenting these abuses, mountains of evidence. But if the Security Council, which is the only body in the UN with enforcement power, is unable or unwilling to act because of a veto, for example, then, as we saw this past week, it shifts over to the General Assembly in an emergency special session under Uniting for Peace. They can adopt a resolution expressing the desire of the whole, virtually the whole international community, as they did, demanding a ceasefire. But there's no way to enforce that. And that's why individual states who have the capacity to bring about compliance with international law have an obligation to do it as well. That's not happening.
Israel says this all started with October 7th and Hamas' attack on Israel. How would you describe Hamas' attack on Israel and Israel's response to it in the term of international law?
Well, first on the date, of course, this is warring parties will always pick a specific date and time and pretend that the conflict started on that date. I think you saw the Secretary General was quite rudely attacked for suggesting that the broader context is a root cause of what has happened there. And there's no doubt that interning 2.3 million civilians year after year after year in a large open air prison, where generations of children are growing up in that cage, where people are being denied food and water and medicine and shelter and hope and a dignified life year after year again, that this is a root cause of conflict. Anyone would resist those circumstances. As you would expect, people under occupation suffering from the brutalities and indignities that they suffer on the West Bank to also resist that occupation. Now, that said, there is also no doubt that armed groups also have obligations under international law, and in particular, the principle of distinction, protecting civilians from their armed attacks. And clearly, several civilians were not protected in that Hamas attack, and there has to be accountability for that as well.
Joe Biden has recently said that after this conflict is over, we need to get back to a two-state solution. In your letter, you say the mantra of a two-state solution has become, and I quote, an open joke in the corridors of the United Nations where we are sitting right now. Is it really an open joke within the corridors of the United Nations? Explain.
It is, and it has been for quite a long time. If you ask somebody in their official capacity about the two-state solution, they will repeat that phrase to you over and over again as the official position of the United Nations. Indeed, it is the official position of the United States. But nobody who follows these circumstances, either from the political side or from the human rights side, believe, one, that a two-state solution is possible anymore. There's nothing left for a Palestinian state that would be sustainable or just or possible in any respect, and everyone knows that. And secondly, that solution never dealt with the problem of the fundamental human rights of Palestinians. So, for example, it would leave them as second-class citizens without full human rights inside the green line, inside what is now Israel proper. And so when people are not talking from official talking points, you hear increasingly about a one-state solution. And what that means is beginning to advocate for the principle of equality of human rights instead of these old political taglines. That would mean a state in which you have equal rights for Christians, Muslims, and Jews based upon human rights and based upon the rule of law. It is what we call for in every other circumstance around the world. And the question is, why is the United Nations not calling for that in Israel-Palestine as well?
What's the answer to that? Why?
Well, I think we have lost the way. You know, up until about 30 years ago, with the advent of the Oslo process, the emphasis of the UN on dealing with the Palestinian situation was international law, was international human rights, was self-determination, was the UN Charter. But something switched at that moment of Oslo, where international law and international standards became subverted to notions of political expediency, to the idea that you have to defer to the parties. That as well is a great deception, because this is not two equal parties. This is occupier and occupied. This is colonizer and colonized. This is one of the most powerful states and militaries in the world, and a besieged and dispossessed people. So the idea with this discrepancy of power that you simply defer to the agreement of the parties, that only means deferring to Israel, which is where the power resides there. And when you leave behind international norms and standards and international law, the thing that you cannot achieve is justice. And without justice, as we all know, there'll never be peace in the Middle East. So I think everybody knows when they talk about it privately that there is no two-state solution, which is possible. But, you know, the political mechanisms of the UN move slowly. It's a shame because we are being left behind by voices in civil society who have been calling out apartheid, who have been calling out the gross violations of human rights, and who have been calling for a situation based on equality and human rights in all of Israel and Palestine.
So there are more people at the UN that would echo what you wrote in your letter, but they're just not in a position to say it.
There are, and dozens, if not more than 100 of them, have reached out to me personally since my letter was leaked, saying how much they agree and support it and how grateful they are that this is now a part of the conversation. And my hope is that the conversation will begin to expand. I also make the point in the letter that all of these points will be resisted powerfully by key member states of the United Nations who have a completely different agenda. But if the UN can just take a principled approach, not just the humanitarian staff and the human rights staff, but the political leaders in the organization, maybe we'll be able to shake loose from this failed paradigm of the last 35 years and move into a situation that brings some hope of protected human rights and a chance for peace as well.
More than 100 UN employees have reached out to you since your letter leaked.
Colleagues have reached out to me from the field, from Palestine itself, from other duty stations, from Geneva and from New York, applauding the sentiments that have been expressed there. I haven't invented anything in that letter. These are points of discussion that are quite common in the halls of the UN.
In your letter, you say that we have much to learn from the millions of people that have come out around the world in recent days and weeks, really, to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians. You specifically mention Jewish human rights defenders who stood in solidarity with Palestinians at a protest in New York City, just a few blocks from where we're at now at Grand Central Station. What can the UN learn from these protests?
Well, look, we've been saying for years that we need to open the doors of the UN wider to civil society. They are quite often the conscience of humanity. We are a heavy organization that carries a lot of politics on our shoulders, pressure from member states in all directions, political challenges to which they are not subjected. But if there is any hope in this situation where state institutions have failed miserably, where international institutions have failed terribly, it is coming from the streets. It is coming from the people in countries around the world who have said they do not accept this paradigm. They do not accept these massive violations of human rights. I was moved so deeply by the protest at Grand Central Station that you mentioned just a few days ago, where thousands of Jewish protesters took to the floor of Grand Central at risk of arrest, many of hundreds of which were arrest, to say, this is not on our behalf. It's not in our name. We stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people. We demand human rights and we demand a ceasefire. Those sentiments are echoed by Muslim protesters and Christian protesters, human rights defenders of every stripe in this city, across the country and across the globe right now.
You lived in Gaza for the better part of 2 years in the 1990s. This seems like it's personal to you.
It's deeply personal to me. You know, when you look at the dehumanization of the Palestinian people that is often so present in the statements of Western politicians, and I'm sorry to say in Western media, I see the faces of people that I know and love in Gaza. I mean, I did a number of missions there, starting with the first Intifada in the late 1980s, human rights monitoring mission, several after that, was posted there for a couple of years, did some missions afterwards. And I don't recognize the portrayal of the Palestinian people in Western media. What I know is that the Palestinian people laugh and they tell jokes and they love and they cry and they cook and they dance and they party, and their children have the same dreams and hopes as the children in the West, and the parents have the same dreams and hopes as the parents in the West. They have been painted with a broad dehumanizing brush. When you see the faces of these people, when you live alongside these people, which is a reality of working in the field anywhere in the world for UN personnel, these horrible depictions that pave the way for genocide, because the first step is always dehumanization. And I think, you know, there is Article 19 of the Covenant on Civil and Political Rights in the UN that protects free speech. There's also Article 20 that imposes obligations not to circulate propaganda for war, propaganda, incitement to discrimination, incitement to violence. And there's been far too much of that. What we would like to see from media voices is a reflection of the humanity of the people who are under those bombs.
Craig Mochaber, the former director of the New York office of the UN High Commissioner of Human Rights, thank you for speaking with Al Jazeera.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to an Al Jazeera report featuring former UN career diplomat Craig Mokeber, discussing his reasons for resigning his job in protest of the UN's failure to adequately address the Israeli-Hamas war. Finally, some meaningful legal action taken by the Center on Constitutional Rights challenging the Gaza genocide perpetrated by Israel and as reported on Democracy Now!
As Israel rejects growing international calls for a ceasefire in Gaza, there are mounting efforts to hold Israel and its backers accountable for committing war crimes in Gaza. Here in the United States, the Center for Constitutional Rights has sued President Biden, accusing him of failing to prevent genocide. Today, CCR is seeking an emergency order to block Biden, as well as Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, from providing further military funding, arms, and diplomatic support to Israel. We're joined now by Catherine Gallagher, senior attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, one of the lawyers who brought the case. Catherine, can you lay out the case for us? What are you demanding of the U.S. government, of President Biden?
Morning, Amy. This case filed on Monday was filed on behalf of two Palestinian human rights organizations, Defense for Children International Palestine, Al-Haq, which is the oldest Palestinian human rights organization, which for the first time in its history is unable to do its work in Gaza because of the conditions, as well as three Palestinians in Gaza and five Palestinian American families who have members of their families killed, injured, and under direct threat right now in Gaza. We filed this case against President Biden, Secretary of State Blinken, and Secretary of State Austin with two claims. One is that they have absolutely and completely failed in their duty under international law and U.S. law to take all measures possible to prevent the unfolding genocide against the Palestinian population in Gaza. The United States is a signatory to the Genocide Convention, and in recognition of the severity that this is the crime of crimes when it requires the specific intent to destroy a group, a national or ethnic group, in whole or in part, that is such a serious crime that states are obligated to take all measures within their control, all measures possible, from the second, from the minute they learn of the possibility of genocide, to stop that. We have not seen the United States do that, despite its considerable influence over Israel in the form of hundreds of billions of dollars in military aid that it sent over the decades and billions in the past year. Instead of using that influence to stop the killing, to stop the imposition of a total siege, denying all basic necessities to 2.2 million people in the enclosed space of Gaza, they have rushed weapons. They have given unconditional political support up until yesterday when we saw a Security Council resolution not yet call for a complete ceasefire. The United States had blocked all measures at the international level. So we are bringing the first claim for its failure to prevent the unfolding genocide. And the second claim is that it's actually complicit in genocide. We lay out the case that Israel is actually committing genocide at this moment. And we are able to do so, unfortunately, it's with no pleasure that we say this, at this early moment because of the very clear statements of intent by Prime Minister Netanyahu, by his Minister of Defense, and other senior Israeli officials about their intentions against the entire population in Gaza. They have been clear that they see this, the people, the children of Gaza, as less than human, describing the population as monsters or human animals, and then taking away all of the basic necessities, food, fuel, water, electricity. We've certainly, as you just played, heard what has happened to the healthcare and medical facilities, bombed and invaded. And so in the face of all of this, the United States, when it has continued to send weapons to send military advisors to rush aid and give moral and political support to Israel's actions. We say it is aiding and abetting genocide.
And so, Catherine, could you, because it seems that there's some disagreement or dispute about whether what's taking place right now is a genocide or ethnic cleansing, even among scholars of genocide. So could you explain the distinction between the two and how it is that the people whom you've had advising you on this case are convinced that what's happening right now, not what is to come, what is unfolding right now is a genocide?
So just to first clarify, ethnic cleansing is actually not a crime. Ethnic cleansing is a description that is often used, whether for crimes against humanity, such as extermination or forcible transfer and deportation. And I want to be very clear, those in and of themselves are serious crimes. The International Criminal Court has jurisdiction over those crimes. And frankly, it should be bringing arrest warrants for those crimes at this moment. So that is the first point. As to why we believe it is a genocide, the elements of genocide are that specific intent to destroy in whole or in part a group, and then there are underlying acts for genocide. And we think three of the five underlying acts are present in this case: killing, causing serious bodily or mental harm, and creating the conditions of life intended to destroy a population in whole or in part. And so to unpack that a bit, what we have at the front end, and usually specific intent is something that needs to be determined and only able to be concluded after the fact. I worked at the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal on the Srebrenica cases, and I know how difficult even in that case it was to make the conclusion that it was genocide. Here, we have those statements up front, and what we have from the Israeli officials is backing up those statements to impose a total siege and deny an entire population the basic necessities of life, the access to, as I said, food, fuel, electricity, which are necessary for hospitals to run, for people to be able to make their food, for water. We are seeing the start of starvation happening. And of course, all of that has happened under intense and continual military bombardment of a space that has a blockade and closed borders. And that blockade has been in place for 16 years. And again, I would say that there have been crimes against humanity being committed against the Palestinian population in Gaza, at least throughout the entirety of that 16-year blockade. What we have seen now is the expression of specific intent to destroy that population. And that, with the killings that we have seen, already over well over 11,000 people have lost their lives, including over 4,600 children. We see that this is a campaign against the entire population. So for genocide, when you take that specific intent, as expressed by the senior Israeli officials who have the capacity to carry out those threats, and then the actions, and we are seeing that they are carrying out exactly what they promised, then you are able to make the case for genocide. And I just want to emphasize again that because of the seriousness of this crime of crimes, the duty to prevent kicks in as soon as a country is on notice of a serious risk of genocide. And the United States has been on notice since at least October 9th, when the Minister of Defense announced the total siege, which was then imposed, if not already on October 7th, when Prime Minister Netanyahu made threats to turn the entire Gaza Strip into rubble and to erase it off the earth. And so that is why we feel that that duty to prevent, if not already liability for complicity, is present. And what we need, we don't need to be quibbling about legal definitions at this moment. What we need is action. We need the President of the United States, the Secretary of State, and the Secretary of Defense to do what the vast majority of the world has been calling for weeks, and that is stop this killing, stop the siege on Gaza. allow the 2.2 million people to live with dignity, to have their rights respected, and to not be subjected to this horror that we have all been witnessing and trying to do whatever we can to make the most powerful country on earth have some compassion and comply with the law.
Catherine Gallagher, we thank you for being with us, senior staff attorney at the Center for Constitutional Rights, which is seeking an emergency order today to block President Biden, as well as Secretary of State Antony Blinken, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, from providing further military funding, arms, and diplomatic support to Israel.
And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at WZBC 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. Eastern Time. If you miss a broadcast or want to hear any of our past broadcasts, go to our archive on the Internet. Just type in truthandjusticeradio.org, all one word, truthandjusticeradio.org, and then click on Archive. It is all there. We thank you for joining us, and we hope you will connect again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.